Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Last May, the Associated Press reported that authorities were barely keeping up with a surge in the amount of heroin flowing into the Columbus area. In August, the Columbus Dispatch reported that heroin is getting cheaper from a combination of better supply lines and more demand. At the same time, many programs that treat the addiction that churns much of the demand has been decimated by budget cuts at the state level. And then in August, the Alcohol, Drug, and Mental Health Board of Franklin County slashed $10.8 million from its Alcohol and Drug Addiction Treatment Services funding. Among them was Youth to Youth, a high school and middle school drug prevention and leadership program that was founded in 1982. Last week, 13 young people, kids in their teens and early 20s, were arrested and charged with trafficking heroin and other drugs, including pot and cocaine. What shocked so many in the community was that the dealing was being done on street corners in Worthington, near schools and at the local Dairy Queen. In a time of budget cuts and increased usage, what are we going to do? Joining me from his office, I believe, in Worthington, is Chief of Police Michael Mauger. Welcome, Chief.
Good morning. How are you today?
Fine, thanks. Thanks for joining us. Also in the studio is Anthony Murata. He's the Assistant Special Agent in charge with the Drug Enforcement Administration. Welcome, Tony.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. And on the treatment side of the equation, we welcome Paul Coleman, President and CEO of Mary Haven. It's a provider of behavioral health care with specialization in addiction recovery care. Welcome, Paul.
Thank you, Ann, and thank you for discussing this important topic.
And finally, David Royer, Chief Executive of the Alcohol, Drug, and Mental Health Board of Franklin County. This isn't funny, but sorry about that, David.
Good morning. Thank you, I think.
Chief, let's start with you. Can you give us an overview of what happened in Worthington and what's going on now?
Yes, what happened, we were contacted by the Special Investigations Unit of the Franklin County Sheriff's, I want to say late July or early August, and Deputy Chief Steve Martin came up to my office along with his lieutenant and told us that they had been making, which we sort of knew because we had helped them out on one previous purchase of drugs in Worthington, and then they elaborated that this had been heroin, and they'd already had 18 targets that they had already made buys off of, and there was a continual process at that time that they wanted to continue making buys, and then come late August or September, or at least in September, the schedule was that they were going to do a warrant roundup of all the traffickers. And that's how this sort of all started, and we kept in contact, and then the deputy chief called me a week before the September 24th date when we went and did the roundup and identified the operation. And basically knew that a lot of the trafficking had been happening in lots that were big enough for public access, which was one at the Worthington Square. We knew about the Dairy Queen, and I didn't know where every place else was. They just sort of gave me the highlights of it. So on September the 24th at 6 a.m., we met up here with a special investigation unit, our officers, and then members of the U.S. Marshals SOFAS Task Force, which is basically an apprehension warrant unit, and began actually taking in custody these young people that were involved in this, and all of them were like 18 to 21. Five of them resided in Worthington, and not all of them. One was a heroin, per se, trafficker, somewhere into ecstasy. We had one girl that was apparently dealing ecstasy, and but the majority was heroin, and then from that, we arrested those, and of course, you know, they got a lot of the media attention.
Chief, you were getting a lot of static. Maybe if you hold the phone just a little bit farther from your mouth, I think.
Does that help?
Yeah, that's much better. Thank you. When we first heard the story, it was that some kids had gotten pulled over in a car and admitted to the officer at the time, yeah, they'd been snorting heroin. What did they have to do with the larger picture there?
That happened the night before. The lieutenant from the Special Investigation Unit said, I just want to let you know this happened last night, because we had been working some other external type stuff before the 24th, that they had stopped a car somewhere in probably what they call Hard Road area, in that general area of northwest Worthington or Columbus area there, and four people were in the car. Two of them were 18-year-olds and two of them were 17-year-olds, and they couldn't, the heroin they got rid of, or somehow they just got rid of the powdered heroin and had paraphernalia, so the county arrested them for the paraphernalia.
Okay.
And two of them they identified as Kilbourne students. Now, I never saw the report on it, but we were sort of interacting that morning. I think the thing that they were trying to enhance is that that's how prevalent it is. I mean, you got them out here driving around with them in their car, so.
Okay, you're listening to Chief Michael Mauger from Worthington Police. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher. If you'd like to join the conversation later, 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Chief, when you talked to our reporter, Christina Morgan, you told her that this is a lower, younger group than you're accustomed to seeing with this kind of drug.
Well, I'd say in recent time. I mean, if you go back to the last, you know, phase in of heroin, which was the China White back in the 70s, mm-hmm. I mean, most of them were over 21, 22, at least they were addicted. I mean, there were younger folks that were involved, but your actual dealers were a little older at that point in time. You mean, they were more mid-20s, later range, at least what we were having contact with. And here you got 18-year-olds that, and I'm sure they're using and taking a piece off and selling it to make money, but I mean, it's just sort of like, I guess because, heroin's such an addictive drug, you sort of sit there and shake your head and go like, you thought by now this wouldn't be happening. But, of course, with the cheaper drug out there, if it's cheaper than anything else out there, they're going to go with that.
Yeah. Tony, from the DEA, what about that age level and participation in the dealing end of it?
Unfortunately, what you have now are young people who don't care what drug they ingest. They start at a younger age. They go into their family's medicine cabinet. Look at going your own medicine cabinet. You have drugs that you didn't dispose of. They get these drugs, Oxycontin, Xanax, things like that. They take them themselves. They introduce it to their friends at school. And before you know it, you have people who are addicted to prescription drugs who then make the step, cocaine, heroin, and things like that to feed that addiction.
Is it just because I grew up in the 70s that there's something really nasty and real nasty connotation to heroin that is, there's no way. Maybe it was because it was a different kind and it was more expensive and out of reach. I don't know, but it doesn't seem to scare the kids.
The stigma. There's not the stigma anymore. You pick up the newspaper, you see these Hollywood stars addicted, they go to rehab, come back, things like that. It's quasi-glorified. So having a child pick up a needle and put it in their arm, to them it's no big deal. They're feeding the hunger.
Chief, when you're picking up these kids, do they look like kids? I was once told that you're really emotionally, you really haven't reached the adult until you're about mid-20s, and these are very young.
Well, yeah, they look like kids. I mean, a couple of them are shell-shocked, or a couple of them were high when we brought them in, and some of them had attitude, I mean, they were just like, this ain't no big deal, The one individual that had the AK-47 and the semi-automatic pistol was pretty hardcore. His whole attitude was like, I won't even get into the language he was using, mm-hmm. but, I mean, he was not exactly, acting penitent of heart for being arrested for this. So, and some of them, when they were getting taken down to the county jail, I think the one female was laughing like, oh, hi, guys, how we're all back together again. So,
Tony, do they not understand, Tony Murata, that they're facing felony charges? What do you get from that?
It's a loss of innocence. They don't think it's reality, just like the chief says. And it doesn't have to happen in central Ohio. We've had that in Missouri, where we round up a big ecstasy ring. They're in from 15 to 20, and they're all laughing, and they don't really care.
Paul Coleman, president, CEO of Mary Haven, what can you tell us about the age group here now that it's getting so much younger, and how do you work with them?
Well, Anne, I can tell you that 75% of all our patients at Mary Haven, that's 3 out of 4, are between the ages of 18 and 25. And that's a real change over the past several years. For example, in 2000, young adults, and that's under 30, comprise 17% of all our patients at Mary Haven. 2009 year to date, 43% of all our patients at Mary Haven. So we have a situation where our patient population is getting a lot younger, which is a good news, bad news kind of thing, because some patients are seeking help. But it's really clear that the incidence and prevalence of drug use in our community is occurring at a much, much younger age.
Tony, the drug abuse, you know, back in the 70s, kids were doing it in high school. It wasn't – the age wasn't bad, but the dealing did tend to be older people. Are you noticing that the age is going down for the dealers?
Well, the level that DEA is using, when we conduct investigations, we work at federal minimum mandatory. So when we're dealing with heroin, we work up these organizations where we have these dealers dealing in kilo weight, 2.2 pounds of heroin, and then they deal down to a middleman, do in ounces, and then it distributes to the younger kids. And you ask, where are they getting the money from? So after big borrowing and stealing, you then have these pretty young girls who have to resort to other means to get that fix. So the high school, it's not only Worthington, like the chief says,
of course,
but it's all of them, and it's a pattern that's just getting worse, and that echoes what we're doing on the streets, grabbing these Mexican traffickers, with large quantities of heroin. Very big appetite here.
David Royer, Adam H.
Yeah, it's interesting. We actually track the amount of individuals that are on our medically assisted program. That's methadone program. And the interesting part about that is that 84% of the folks that are on our methadone programs are Caucasian, but there are more women on methadone than there are men. The interesting thing is over the last 4 years, the percentage of people starting methadone between 18 and 25 continues to go up every year. So this trend towards more women, younger, it's all following the patterns as part of our methadone program in Franklin County.
We got to take a break real quick, but I was wondering, as far as the gender goes, do you think that's possibly because more women tend to be more willing to go seek treatment, go get help? They have children sometimes. They're just different that way.
I think a lot of the trending has been more because of the prescription drug abuse and the fact that it's being more and more difficult to acquire the illegal prescription drugs than it used to be.
Well, we got to take a break right now. I'm going to do that before I have to interrupt somebody in the middle of a sentence. You are listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We will be right back. This is WOSU 820 NPR News.
WOSU News reports on the stories you need to hear and the stories you want to hear.
Rivka was a Muslim, but now she says she's a Christian, an act Rivka says is unforgivable by the Islam faith and her family.
They're pinning this not just on the family, but saying, you know, that this is what Islam teaches. No, that couldn't be farther from the truth.
Get more from your news with the award-winning WOSU News team on WOSU 89.7 FM, NPR News, and classical music.
Good morning. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News. 53 degrees in downtown Columbus at 10:20. A slight chance of rain today, cloudy skies, and chilly with a high of only 58 degrees.
Support for WOSU comes from Palmer Miller Nelson Insurance Agency Incorporated, serving Central Ohio homeowners and businesses for 154 years. 261-6300 or online at pmnins.com.
And now back to All Sides with Ann Fisher.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about the heroin problem in Central Ohio, really everywhere, with law enforcement officials and how we're talking with law enforcement officials about the heroin problem and how we are responding to the need for drug addiction treatment with the top officials at Adam H. and Mary Haven. Let's get back to that talk about the gender issue. Tony, you mentioned it earlier. Let's talk a little bit more about that progression into drugs. So we all hear about the gateway drugs. But the gateway drug used to be beer, and now it's, you know, Vicodin in the medicine cabinet. And, Paul, you mentioned how that turns into – how does that happen on the street where they're looking for their drug, they can't find it, and then someone offers them something different?
And a typical story of our patients who come to us for help at Mary Haven for addiction to opiates will be something like, a year ago I hurt my back. Then I went to a doctor and was prescribed prescription opiates, synthetic opiates like Vicodin or OxyContin. I began using them in excess. Maybe I shopped for prescription drugs. After a while, that didn't work because the physicians caught on. I found that I could buy these prescription drugs on the street. Tony can tell you that pharmacies are being robbed in our community, not for money, but for synthetic opiates.
Tony, is there any statistic on the robberies in pharmacies? Any uptick?
DEA has a diversion program that monitors pharmacies, doctors like that. We're constantly getting calls by pharmacies, people breaking in and stealing the opiates. The biggest is OxyContin, which is a heroin substitute. And once that runs out, $50 to $80 a pill, it's cheap. You still have that craving, that physical addiction. So you'd rather go on the streets, $10 or $15. And unfortunately, you just don't have these junkies turn out to be housewives, working people. It's not the dirty drug you remember.
Yeah. And our patients at Mary Haven at the end of the progress of their illness, they will say things to us like, I never thought I'd be sticking a needle into my arm. But that's how they got started, with the synthetic opiates.
Susan, you're on the air. You want to talk about what needs to be done in the home?
Yeah.
Could you pull the phone a little bit away from your mouth?
Yes, I'm sorry.
Thank you.
I am. Is that better?
Yes, it's much better.
When we talk about children, high school children and younger, I've seen a really disturbing pattern in the schools. I know there was another suburban school where a young man in his senior year was found dealing marijuana on campus. And the parents sweep in with their $400 an hour attorneys and, you know, make it go away, force the schools to drop the charges, and the schools kind of roll over. And it seems to me more and more that the parents early on in life, even early first, second, third grade, instead of allowing the child to accept the consequences of their behavior at that point, they intervene, they take the child's side against the teacher, against the schools, against the police, and they kind of teach the child that they're going to be insulated and that no harm will come to them.
You know, I see what you mean about the $400 an hour lawyers, but you really can't force anybody to drop charges once they're issued. Is that right, Tony? What happens with that? What do you, when, you know, you're looking at a 16, 17-year-old kid who's been dealing drugs and you know they may go to prison.
If they're caught drug trafficking in the schools, they're expelled.
Automatic. No matter what.
Exact. We've seen that. Somebody dealing just Xanax in the school, besides marijuana, like the caller says. And it all comes down to kids are not taking responsibility for their actions. So the school then steps in and they're expelled.
Paul, what about that parental involvement?
Well, my advice to Susan and other parents who are concerned about this is that you absolutely must be involved in your children's lives. You must know what they're doing at school. You must know what kind of movies they're watching and television programming. But the most important thing we find at Mary Haven, and national research bears this out, you must know who their friends are. I agree with Susan that sometimes parents can be what we in the behavioral health care field call enablers. And I think in addition to consulting legal counsel, should that happen to your children, you must consult an addiction treatment professional so that you don't end up saving the child from that consequence only to have more serious consequences in the future.
Chief, are you still on the line?
Sure.
Oh, thanks. I can't hear you very well.
Can you hear me now?
Oh, yeah, I hear you great now. I want to let you go soon. I know you're going to be taken off, but I wanted to ask you about what was the parental reaction when they were picking up these kids the other night?
I think it was shock. You know, we're coming like 7 o'clock, 7:30 in the morning. You know, they're standing there and knocking on the door, and I think the media had one mother on later that night. I don't know which channel, and she was like totally, you know, amazed about it. And the ironic part about it was she was one of the people, I think, that was dealing in ecstasy, and she's flushing the ecstasy down the toilet as the officers are coming up there to arrest them. So, a lot of parents just, you know, sort of turn a blind eye, and I understand that. You know, it's like you don't want to believe, or there's not a big change in the child's behavior or physical appearance. But, you know, it's not something new. I mean, we've dealt with this,
right.
And Tony will tell you over the, I mean, I can go back to the 70s and tell you we had young people here in their 20s hooked on white, China white heroin that were doing drugstore robberies and house burglaries to get money and stealing for drugs back then. So it's sort of a cycle thing. I'm afraid that if the heroin thing kicks in really strong again in this county, we're going to see a lot more violent crime come out of it with drugstore robberies and stuff.
Okay, Chief, I'm going to let you go now. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Sure thing, Ann. Anytime.
Take care. The crime follows the addiction. Tony?
Unfortunately, the problem is here. It's not coming. The problem is here.
Okay.
We have illegal Mexican cells dealing tremendous quantities of heroin, and the only difference is we don't have the associated violence at this time. But who knows? That's follows a logical progression.
Describe the overall what sort of statistics describe what we're facing right now?
For example, in 2000, we had two large federal investigations. 2008, we have 12. We've been doing wiretaps with the U.S. attorney on a regular basis, following narcotics back to the Mexico and the southwest border states. We have other DEA offices throughout the country on the southwest border calling us, giving us not only intelligence but organizing controlled deliveries to these illegal Mexican cells. And it's all coming here to Central Ohio. We're not talking grams, ounces. We're talking pounds, kilograms. And these organizations are in for one bit. They're in to make a profit. That's what they do. It's a full sale business. They make a profit, and right now is a very fertile market here. Law enforcement has fine-tuned their operations. We have more ad hoc task forces, and we have specific groups at DEA and Southwest Border Task Force that just deals with these Mexican violators.
But until we deal with the demand, ultimately, it'll never go away. Paul Coleman from Mary Haven?
I think that's absolutely correct, Ann, and I also think that Tony is correct. The problem is not coming. The problem is here. I think it's important to have both supply reduction strategies, which Tony works hard at and which law enforcement does, but also demand reduction strategies like David Royer and I work with. I will tell you that in response to the growing rise of opiates in our community, with a grant from the Adam H. Board and the Columbus Medical Association Foundation, we opened a specialized treatment program for opiate treatments here in Franklin County, and with support of the Delaware Morrow Mental Health and Recovery Services Board, we now have a specialized opiate treatment program in Delaware and Morrow County.
We have an email from Hal right now. He asks, isn't methadone a synthetic opiate, and what's the difference between methadone and the stuff that's stolen from the pharmacies?
Hal is absolutely right. Methadone is a synthetic opiate. Although what it does is it allows a person who is addicted to an opiate to withdraw in a much easier way and to continue their recovery with medication assistance. Methadone does not give the intense high that you would get from other opiates, whether natural or synthetic.
You are listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. If you'd like to join the conversation, 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We're talking about the problem, the heroin problem in Central Ohio. And joining me in the studio today earlier was Worthington Chief of Police Michael Mauger. Now it's Tony Marotta, Assistant Special Agent in charge with the Drug Enforcement Administration. Also, Paul Coleman, President and CEO of Mary Haven. And finally, David Royer, Chief Executive of the Alcohol, Drug, and Mental Health Board of Franklin County. David, you've been going through a lot of cuts lately. And you kind of see a cycle here. They're cutting you off at the knees. It seems the demand is what needs to be addressed ultimately. But we are taking money away from the programs that do that. And that's not to say cuts should come from law enforcement. They're needed in both. I just feel, are we throwing good money after bad?
Well, you know, the problem we're facing right now is that we've never seen the types of reductions we're experiencing in Franklin County, or for that matter statewide in the state of Ohio, from the state budget. Since October of last year, we've cut over $14 million. Just from Franklin County, of treatment access. Now, the other interesting part of that is, or the sad part is that those services that were cut tend to be for non-Medicaid recipients. So if there's a young person who, by the nature of their situation, is not a Medicaid-eligible person, we have been seriously degrading access to care over the past year because of these state budget reductions. And so the young males, young females that may not necessarily be Medicaid-eligible have to simply sit and wait longer and longer for treatment. What we did try to do, or what we have done, is we've protected methadone treatment, we've protected emergency psychiatric services, we've protected detoxification services, because those are crisis first response services within the behavioral health context. So while we've done that, and that's helpful and that's supportive to the immediate emergency-oriented situation for our consumers, the long-term treatment aspects for those without Medicaid has been seriously degraded. Our waiting lists, frankly, are getting longer and longer.
What is it? I mean, what kind of waiting list are we talking about?
Paul?
We have a severe over-demand for all of our services, Ann, at Maryhaven. Detoxification, we can generally admit a person now within 36 to 48 hours. We would like to have pretty much on-demand admission, because we do lose some people who can't wait that long and just disappear back into the drug-using community. For our longer-term programs, you don't even want to know what the wait period is.
Yeah, it's significant, and they're only going to grow, unfortunately, because the cuts that we've put out there due to the state budget, while many of them took effect in September of this year, the most over 50% will start in January of 2010. And so we're currently negotiating with our provider community about the nature of those cuts. But one can expect that drug treatment will become more difficult, as well as outpatient mental health care. And a lot of the folks that we deal with, the 41,000 people that seek treatment, really are co-occurring disordered. So the notion that they're one or the other, those days are pretty much gone.
Right. Tony, what are you seeing from your end? How does law enforcement approach that whole issue of you're arresting people, you're charging them with felonies, they may go to prison. Some of these kids may go to prison. They're not necessarily going to get the treatment they need in prison.
Enforcement is only one part of the puzzle.
Right.
What these two gentlemen do is probably – we're seeing the end the product. We got people who are selling and ruining lives. We need these DARE programs that start at a very young age. Enforcement is one piece of the puzzle. You have people that are taking this who have mental problems, who have addiction issues, and then you have these junkies who – want to get into these Maryhaven programs. And when you hear that it's a year or two to get into a bed, there's only so many resources. So, you know, sometimes you're trying to sweep the tide back. You know, we're only making so many strides forward. And these gentlemen are dealing with the broken toys, so to speak. They go into their program and they're trying to repair their lives. So enforcement is just one part of the puzzle.
Sometimes you hear from the enforcement end that they're frustrated, that sometimes drug users or drug abusers or drug dealers get off light, or criminals get off light. And it happens. There's negotiations and that sort of thing. But when it comes to drug abuse and drug addiction and the mental illness that often is associated with it, how do you feel about that as part of the enforcement end of it?
You know,
because as you said earlier, this is everybody's community. You live here too.
With the drug abuse, you drop a pebble in a pond. You see those rings that go out? So the abuser drops it. What you have assaults, you have robberies, you have rapes, you have diseases. And who bears the ultimate is the taxpayer. because there's a drain on the police, there's a drain on the medical community and things like that. A lot of these people don't have any insurance. So the taxpayer has a vested interest to have these things funded, because if not, we're going to be paying in the end as a taxpayer.
Tony, you're exactly right. I'd just like our listening audience to know that a recent study funded by the Columbus Foundation demonstrates that for every dollar invested in adult treatment at Mary Haven, our community saves $11 in health care and justice system cost alone. And that, of course, does not deal with the human cost that Tony has just outlined.
The human cost, and at a very human level, the thought of waiting a year for anything, let alone drug addiction services, seems it would just be overwhelming, it, particularly in our society where we want to go drive up to a drive-through window and get it right away. Brandon, you say drug use is a signifier of desperation. You're on the line.
Hi. Yeah, that kind of summarizes it. I don't think people go looking for highs on drugs if their lives are satisfactory. You don't go searching for something else if you've already got something good. And I think a lot of these people need help, you know, trying to get their lives in order, trying to get traction in the world, because it's not really easy to make it out here. I think they need more help. I think we need to be a little more trusting of people early on in their lives. And I think we need to, you know, just help them get on their feet before we decide to start, you know. We need to make it easier to make it, you know, to put it simply.
What do you mean by make it easier? Make what easier?
It's a difficult thing to get into school. You know, it's difficult to pay, you know, 10 grand a year for college. You know, it goes on and on. I mean,
I see you're saying that they don't have any, they don't have a lot of hope in life in general sometimes.
Right. I mean, you know, it starts from early age. You know, these are sometimes kids who don't, you know, don't do so well in school. You know, they don't have good homes to go home to.
Right.
They don't have a lot of good friends to be around. So they're kind of screwed from the beginning, you know. I think we need to see more stability, just more, you know, more human engagement,
right,
in community.
Thanks, Brandon.
Thanks.
Yeah.
One of the things that when I brief community leaders and at the local level here about some of the decisions we're being forced to make right
at
now
at Adam H.
About the reduction of access to care is that I try to make the point that these are inescapable costs, and that the question becomes how are we going to embrace these costs? And unfortunately, I think as the access to treatment, whether it's in the mental health aspects or the addiction aspects, gets harder and harder, what we see is that jail populations are going to go up, prison populations are going to go up, the homeless will go up. We'll just have a recycling. So the notion that somehow if we save a dollar here, we're you know, it's material, in our business, I don't believe it is. I think it's just a matter of where we choose to invest in it and where we choose to spend it.
I want to get back to that in a second. We are going to take a short break right now. We're talking about heroin, the heroin trade and treatment in Central Ohio. When we return, we'll continue talking to David Royer of Adam H. about the funding for drug treatment in Central Ohio. Give us a call at 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org to join the conversation. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News. We'll be right back.
Support WOSU Public Media by becoming a volunteer today. WOSU is currently looking for a daytime volunteer to assist with the administration of the volunteer program. You must be computer proficient and may go through an application and interview process. For more information on this and other volunteer opportunities, visit us online at wosu.org/volunteers. And thanks for supporting WOSU.
And good morning. Thanks for joining us for All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News. In 20 minutes, Hour 2 of All Sides will be here. We'll discuss concerns about the lack of civility in political discourse, how to improve civility, and respect for the views of others. And we'll look at the history of political language in Ohio politics. That's on All Sides with Ann Fisher at 11 o'clock, right here on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Support for WOSU comes from Integrate, helping to improve business performance through brand design and marketing communications for more than 20 years. On the web at integrateinc.com or at 614-421-0004.
54 degrees in downtown Columbus. Clouds today with a slight chance of rain and a high of 58. Cloudy tonight with a low around 50 degrees. Clouds Wednesday morning and then some sunshine in the afternoon and a high of 63. There's a good chance of patchy frost overnight Wednesday night with a low around 40 degrees. And now back to All Sides with Ann Fisher.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about the heroin trade and drug addiction treatment in Central Ohio. We were just talking to David Royer of Adam H. about the funding issue. Voters tend to approve issues.
Yes, actually, Franklin County's had historically just tremendous support for the issues of mental health care and addiction treatment. And if it wasn't really for the voters of Franklin County with our levy, I give you an idea. In 2005, we won by 63%. That's compared to our state norms. That's a tremendous show of support. I'm not sure where we would be. And we actually – it's gotten to the point where in Franklin County, through our levy, we actually contribute more funding for addiction treatment than the state of Ohio appropriates statewide for addiction treatment. The decline in state funding for addiction treatment as well as mental health care is at a historic all-time low. And when you factor the demand that continues to grow – it really puts providers such as Mary Haven in a very, very difficult situation.
Is your funding strictly state and local?
State, local, and federal.
Okay.
And what we're having is an increasing clash between people with Medicaid in the sense that they get entitled to treatment right away and people with non-Medicaid, or that is the working poor, non-insured, young people that just don't invest in health care insurance, they're being forced to wait, frankly, for extended periods of time before they can receive behavioral health care.
Yeah, Paul, at Mary Haven, what's the funding like over there?
Well, it's pretty dire. We were stunned by the magnitude of the state reductions in support for behavioral health care. And I think David makes a very good point that we are now starting to look at various populations and who we can get paid for and who we can't. Mary Haven's core mission for 53 years has been to provide behavioral health to people who need it, regardless of their ability to pay. And were it not for the Adam Board and the support from the people of Franklin County through the levy, we would be in terrible straits. We are the ones, not me. I'm the CEO. I try and stay out of people's way who do the real work. But our admitting officers, our clinicians, our nurses have to decide every day, not how they're going to fit round pegs into square holes, but how they're going to fit 20 round pegs into 10 round holes. And we do, in good times, do an awful lot of uncompensated care at Mary Haven. These are not good times. So naturally, you might suspect that our uncompensated care is going to have to drop.
David, when you talk to public officials about the funding problem and you show them the statistics and they cut it anyway, what do they say?
Most of the time what I hear at the state level is these are very difficult times. I think we hear we can't raise taxes right now. And I think one of the fundamental points I try to make to them is that if we don't take care of our disabled citizens, if we don't make sure that there's access to care for these kinds of problems, that it's just simply that the prison budgets will grow, the jail budgets will grow, the homeless encampments will grow.
Law enforcement.
Demands on law enforcement grow. The other thing is sometimes we forget is the demand on emergency paramedics and fire services. So, you know, it's a question of where do we want to spend it and how wisely do we want to spend it. Obviously, as a career professional, I think the current situation is at an all-time low in my 30 years. And it's a very distorted approach towards helping people with disabilities.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. If you'd like to join the conversation, call us at 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Delbert, you want to ask about the marijuana laws and how they might affect harder drugs.
Yes, because I'm of the mind that because of the stipulations against marijuana, and marijuana was very popular when I was a kid and coming up, but the violence wasn't near at the rate that it is now. And not only that, but the last three presidents dibbled or dabbled to some degree with marijuana and went on to become president. But since marijuana is so easily detected, that kids are using other drugs that are not so easily detected, and maybe some are more harmful.
Okay, you're saying that because marijuana is easy to smell, I guess,
yeah,
and easy to find, and it's bigger, and they are not going with marijuana in favor of an OxyContin pill, which is easier to conceal.
Yeah.
What do you say about that, Tony? Thanks for calling, Delbert.
I think the marijuana use, it's definitely a starting drug. And let's throw alcohol in that.
Right.
Kids start off alcohol, smoking, natural progression, marijuana to cocaine, and depending which route they take and the friends they hang out with could very well take that left turn into heroin. It's a stepping stone drug.
But it's a stepping stone drug. Is it from an addiction standpoint only, or is it also from a social standpoint that if you're going to do marijuana and cocaine, you're probably going to come in contact with other drugs, and you're probably going to use them just because they're there when you're 17 years old.
Absolutely. You're always looking for a bigger and better high.
Yeah. Paul.
Accessibility is what drives demand for drugs. We've been talking about the problem with heroin. Tony, I think, has outlined the fact that we have a very great oversupply of heroin in this community, and that's why we're seeing heroin at Mary Haven and other treatment centers in our community. Marijuana is very easy to get, and just as a matter of interest, we ask our patients at Mary Haven, what is your drug of choice? And our adolescent patients, and we have the largest adolescent treatment unit in the community for young people between the ages of 12 and 18, they tell us that their number one drug of choice is marijuana, and second is alcohol.
So why aren't they getting busted for marijuana, or are they?
You know what? When you're talking about busting somebody from marijuana, the federal government, we deal with people who are 21 and over, and you're not dealing with the individual user. That's, you know, you have these young kids. Where are their families? They're out getting high. You know, I firmly believe the core of the issue is at the family unit. You have to be involved in your children's lives. So, you know, getting busted at school, doing this, marijuana being decriminalized across the United States because it's so available and it's just looked down as a weed is part of the problem too.
We're not taking this seriously enough.
It's a stepping stone drug.
But you mentioned smoking, nicotine,
cigarettes,
alcohol. Alcohol is legal. Mm-hmm. They ended the prohibition on that.
Absolutely, but you know it's controlled, quote unquote. You have to be 21. You know, it goes by state, but there's always the diversion of legal substance to illegal means, alcohol. OxyContin, legal, but it's diverted for illegal means. And so they're getting high, be it pot, alcohol, pills, whatever.
Yeah, David.
The thing that I think really scares me, so to speak, I think it both as a parent but also as a professional, is the price point that we're seeing on the heroin. The price point is an astounding low price point, you know, $15-$20 for a balloon.
Which is what you would want for a day?
No, you could have somebody that they're shooting 5-6 times a day. It's for that immediate short-term high. They're only paying anywhere from $10 to $20.
Yeah, and when you compare that to the OxyContin price points, so when you have a readily available supply, a low price point, you have recreational drug users that say, "Hey, try this," and within the culture, I think it really presents a significant risk to the community over the long term. because of the accessibility and relative cheapness of this Mexican heroin.
Is the Mexican heroin easy to transport, or is there just so many people working at making the moves with it that
it's? You have the black tar heroin out of Mexico. You have the brown heroin out of Colombia. It's transported. You know, they're bringing it in suitcases and trucks, in campers. It's like anywhere you could secrete a loaf of bread. It's, you know, it they have in. They take motors apart in trucks and secrete it in engine blocks. They put it in toys, anything. Anything, how it's a smuggling. These people are smugglers. And any ingenious way to get a narcotic across the border. It's porous. And the southwest border is anywhere from Texas to L.A. And how many tens of millions of people come across every day? We're only scratching the surface, and that's just here in central Ohio, when every time we're turned on to another illegal drug trafficking group that we never heard of, and then we bust them, and they're dealing with 10, 15 kilos of heroin a month. We're talking central Ohio. This is not New York, L.A., Chicago. That's how you could see the problem we have.
Can you describe to me how big a kilo is?
A kilo is 2.2 pounds.
Okay.
So you could flatten it. It's like a brick.
Put it in a gallon of milk.
A brick, absolutely.
Yeah. Okay.
You know, and David and Tony have both made good points about the oversupply and the price point of opiates in our community. The New York Times in May of this year did an article on heroin in the Heartland, and they interviewed one of our Mary Haven patients who made the astounding statement that it is as easy to get heroin in Columbus as it is to get a six-pack of beer.
Well, you're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. As you can tell from the last comment, we're talking about heroin and the problem with it. We're a little bit in the wake of that arrest in Worthington last week of 13 kids, late teens, early 20s. Bill's on waiting to talk to us. I'm curious about what you have to say, Bill, about the pluses and minuses of treating these drugs as alcohol. And we're running out of time. I want to get to as many people as possible. Hey, Bill.
Hi. That's the general topic. More specifically, I'd like to ask, where are the break points or cutoff points, economically speaking? How low must the cost of heroin get if it's sold through state stores before you drive these smugglers out of business? And how high do you have to keep it in order to fund the treatment and prevention using income from the state to, in other words, sell it, make enough money to work on the other end and get rid of the law enforcement costs?
Okay, Bill, so what you're getting at is legalizing the drugs so that the taxes from or the revenue tax revenue from the legalized drugs would pay for the treatment, right? Oh, I'm sorry. I cut you off. You can't even answer that question. But what about that? I mean, the legalization of the drugs, that's getting to be a more common conversation. Mm-hmm. All the time, particularly marijuana. Yeah.
You know, Anne, I don't think any of the three of us, myself at Mary Haven, David Royer at Adam, or Tony Marotta at the DEA, would be any happier than if drug abuse just went away.
And put you out of business.
Put us out of business, absolutely. But I'll tell you, legalization of drugs is precisely the wrong way to do it. We've had experience recently in several countries that have tried it to some degree, and they have all reversed course.
They've changed their mind and gone back to criminalizing it.
Scandinavian countries, I don't remember which one, legalized heroin. You ended up having every junkie across Europe flooding that country. You couldn't walk in a park without stepping on needles. It was the degradation of their society. And what happened? They went back in and enforced the laws and put it back on the books. This is not, in my opinion, this is not about economics, taxing it and making money and putting money in the coffers. We're talking about broken lives and getting human beings back on track.
You know, one thing that I've thought about the brown heroin is that it's being snorted a lot. It's not – you don't have to use a needle to get it. And you get addicted just as easily snorting it as you do mm-hmm. shooting it up. But that it's more accessible to kids because of that.
The intense high is shooting it.
Okay.
Injecting it right into the veins. Smoke it, snort it, shoot it. that's here, the more you once you start snorting it, you're addicted. It's not nothing's going to stop you from just putting that needle in your arm.
David Royer of Adam, how do you set priorities right now? What are you talking about? I mentioned earlier the youth to youth program that was that had been cut. How do you make those tough decisions right now?
Well, the way we've tried to do it is we identified a set of principles, and they kind of fall in an order. One is we're mandated to make sure that people with severe and persistent mental illnesses have access to care. Children with severe emotional disorders and people with addictions. Unfortunately, in many of these prevention programs, while we're trying to make sure that the prevention services are within our community, a lot of the big ticket prevention programs have had to go by the wayside. The other thing that we try to make sure is hospitalization, detoxification, methadone, crisis psychiatric services are always available. Those have to be available 24/7, 365. After that, it's literally then trying to make a budget fit and make those programs fit. So there is a set of principles. The other principle is we want geographic locations around the county. We think it's important that whether it's Concord and Westerville, Dublin counseling over here at UA, that those services be available. So we've tried to balance geography based on priorities, emergency-oriented services, crisis services, as we approach 2010.
Well, we're running out of time. We could probably talk about this for a lot longer. It's very interesting seeing all the different pieces in the puzzle and sharing your thoughts today. I appreciate you being here. You've been listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Many thanks to my guests, Anthony Murata of the Drug Enforcement Administration, Worthington Police Chief Michael Mauger in the first part of the show, David Royer, CEO of the Alcohol, Drug Addiction, and Mental Health Board of Franklin County, and Paul Coleman, President and CEO of Mary Haven. Thank you very much for being here. I hope you come back again.
Thank you.
All right. This is WOSU 820 NPR News.